This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And hey, it's the 51st anniversary of Star Trek.
Yes, we are boldly going into another anniversary that Paramount is not appropriately acknowledging.
Yeah, but you know, they're just celebrating a couple weeks late, I think, this year with the release.
Well, CBS is celebrating.
Yeah, that's true. True. Paramount. Yeah, they don't really care. So hey, maybe Paramount will say like, hey, yes, this new movie is happening, and it's being directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, coming to you, 2018.
Anything is possible. I think that all of the stuff they have up, we've talked about this for the DC movies, everything they're considering. Sure. I think that's possible now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, in celebration of the 50th anniversary and, you know, with a new pilot on the way, we thought it would be cool to somehow talk about, you know, that, where we are now and everything, and also with Discovery starting up in just a couple weeks. So here's the thing. There's some minor news, which, I mean, is minor to, I guess, most people, but
not to us.
Yeah, we were pretty excited about this. You know, there was an article, you know, one of these many profiles now, which we're seeing about Discovery, in which they were talking about the behind-the-scenes turmoil, and they specifically stated the writing credits for the pilot for Discovery, which, I mean, it's exciting because there aren't that many Star Trek pilots, and seeing who's writing those pilots, who's setting the course for a series is very interesting.
Yeah.
And for Discovery, you know, we had originally heard that the pilot was written by Fuller and Kurtzman, but of course, there have been changes which have been made and all that good stuff. So the way that the credits break down now, according to this article, are story by Brian Fuller and Alex Kurtzman, screenplay by Brian Fuller and Akiva Goldsman, which is very interesting because, for one thing, it definitely shows that Goldsman's role on this series is very substantial, you know, even if that was his only contribution, which we already know it's not. We already know that he's directing a couple episodes. You know, there's that. But then there's also the idea that it's not written by Berg and Harberts, which I don't think that necessarily means anything. We know that they're the showrunners. It says so, I think, in that very same article. But just the idea that, you know, for whatever reason, it was like, we're giving this to Goldsman. He's going to be rewriting the script, you know?
I don't know. I mean, it makes sense because Berg and Harberts, I probably, because they came on board when Fuller was still, you know, a more substantial part of everything. And so I think it would, in a sense, make sense to hand it over to Goldsman to say, we need a fresh set of eyes because we know that we agree with everything he did, but maybe we just want somebody else in here to freshen it up and just have that different take.
That could be. That could be. Regardless of any of that, yeah, those are the credits. It's Goldsman and Fuller. You know, I'm assuming Goldsman rewriting Fuller. I'm guessing the two of them didn't, you know, collaborate together in the same room.
Doubtful, yeah.
So we thought it might be interesting to take a look at another Goldsman script, which was an adaptation of something written by, in this case, an original series writer. Richard Matheson wrote the novel I Am Legend, and the screenplay for the most recent film, starring Will Smith, was co-written by Akiva Goldsman. And, you know, this kind of gets into, and I guess we'll talk about the quality of this movie, but to me, this kind of gets into that whole thing that we were talking about before of, like, people bashing on Goldsman every chance they get, and him, you know, being, you know, like one of these monsters who you see in I Am Legend or whatever. And I just don't agree with that. I mean, yeah, he's made some really bad movies. I'm not going to dispute that at all, but he's also made some really, really great movies. And I Am Legend, I think, to me anyway, and I know that we've sort of discussed, you know, some of his stuff. I mean, Batman Forever is definitely my favorite Goldsman movie. Like, by far, you know, that, but
I've grown as a person, and I'm just going to walk right past that comment.
Okay. You know, I mean, but I fully admit that that has a lot to do with my personal history, and I can't see the forest through the trees when it comes to Batman Forever. You know, that's perfectly legit. But if I'm going to look at things objectively, I personally think that I Am Legend is his best script, and I think that it's a hell of a script. I don't know. I mean, what do you think about I Am Legend? I guess before, I mean, before I just gave my opinion of it. But before we go any further, do you want to give a description of I Am Legend?
I do. I Am Legend is, we talked about the book, actually, back when we were doing Commentary Trek Stars. And so this is an update slash adaptation of that. But at the same time, it blends in elements of a previous adaptation called The Omega Man that was starring Charlton Heston, which is honestly one of the, I really think it's a much more influential and foundational horror sci-fi work than people realize sometimes. But this is an attempt to get closer to the actual book, the actual source material. Although it still carries elements of, you have a scientist, you know, who's working on the cure, which is not really an element that you're going to find in Matheson's original book. That, like, that's a huge stark difference right there. But basically with this film, Will Smith is a scientist who has inadvertently caused the end of the world by engineering a cure to something that goes sideways. We have our underlying mythos with sci-fi, you know, we go back and forth on scientists, and in this one it's the unintended consequences of trying to control the world. And so we're with Will Smith and his dog as they go through and they set up the end of the world. There are essentially zombies, and then inevitably he comes across some other survivors and learns to live again.
Yes, he does. So what did you think about the movie?
I really enjoyed it. This is one of the ones where the ending debate is very strong. You always go back and forth about the ending, because I think that with the way this is structured, an ending that satisfies everybody is impossible, because people are going to want it to go one way or go the other way. But overall, I thought it was great. I think Will Smith's performance is very, very moving and affecting. There are some tremendous emotional moments in the film. And it's our first hint of a Batman-Superman team-up movie. Because as he's going through Times Square after the end of the world, there is a giant billboard for Batman and Superman, the movie. So yeah. That was in their brains back then.
That's true. And, you know, the date on there kind of bothers me, because, like, this movie came out in 2007. Because,
yeah, 2007.
Yeah, because the IMAX version of this movie had the Dark Knight prologue attached to the front of it. That was where we got our first glimpse of the Joker. I remember going to Navy Pier and seeing this thing, you know, there, and just being like, oh, my God, that prologue is amazing, you know. And then here we have it, you know, the date on the poster, I think, is 2010. And it's like, wait, but Nolan's not going to be done with his trilogy yet, right? You know, whatever. But
that's the odd thing. I saw 2010 and I just thought to myself, there's no way they turn this around in production so fast.
That's true, too. So, yeah. But apparently that was kind of an inside joke I read online, because Goldsman did a draft of the Batman versus Superman movie, which was in development back then. There was a Batman Superman movie which came fairly close to getting made, which was written, I think, primarily by Andrew Kevin Walker, the guy who wrote Seven, and it was going to be directed by Wolfgang Peterson, the guy who did Das Boot and Air Force One. But
that would have been, there's some alternate reality where that happened, and it would be so gloriously interesting.
Yes,
to see that.
It would. They do have like a lot of things in a way. They sort of like predicted the comic book revolution in terms of movies. They've got, like, in the video store, posters up for a Green Lantern movie and a Teen Titans movie and all this stuff.
Now, and just so everybody knows, this was released by Warner Brothers. So yeah, it was an easy leap for them to say, you know, hey, look, here are all these great movies that and properties that we don't have to pay anybody for to put in our film.
Yeah, yeah, it's smart. It's cool. It's a good way of making things slightly futuristic. But yeah, you know, the ending, I mean, that was like a whole thing. Like, I remember when this movie came out, and Max, our co-host on commentary, Trek Stars, you know, he was a huge fan of the book. And when we were working together at the time as projectionists, and the thing came out, and he was going to screen it. And I remember him going into the theater with this sort of, like, you know, almost like Will Smith in the movie when he's gearing up to, like, go outside or whatever. You know, this kind of feeling of, like, I've been down this road before, I know what's coming at me, I know it's not going to be good, but I'm ready for it, you know? And he comes out of the movie, and I'm like, what did you think? And he's like, it was bad, but for a second there, I thought they were going to make it good. I thought they were going to do that thing that none of the other adaptations did and actually do the ending for real. And then they didn't. And what he's talking about, I mean, and I guess at this point, we kind of have to spoil things in order to talk about this ending, but it is a 10-year-old movie. And you know,
and I also think that it's impossible to truly spoil the ending of an I Am Legend adaptation. It has to end a certain way. Like, the world is not going to be restored by the end of it.
I guess in that sense, but there's two ways that you can go with it, which are like the two endings that we have here, you know?
Yeah.
In the original theatrical cut, which was a reshoot of some sort, you know, basically he comes up with a cure and then, you know, hands it off and sacrifices himself in order to kill some, you know, vampires or whatever they are, in order to let a couple of other survivors get away with the cure and bring it back to humanity and save the world. You know, he's a legend. But the way that the book is written, and the way that this ending, you know, in the alternate version is presented, which I think everyone sort of considers to be the true version of this movie, he does come up with a cure, and then he comes to the realization that they don't want to be cured. They are their own new race of beings, their own new culture, and they see him as a monster. And his thing to do, the thing that he should do, is, as he says, listen and let them live their lives and stop trying to, quote unquote, save them. And there's like this whole thing with like this imagery, which is, you know, it runs throughout the entire movie, of the idea of like a butterfly, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The butterfly is very important.
And, you know, butterflies obviously symbolize transformation and all this stuff. And when you watch the original version, it's like butterfly, butterfly, butterfly. And, okay, that's it's interesting how they have a lot of butterflies in this. But in the in the alternate version, in the real version, it's like it all leads to this thing where it's like, you know, he says, I'm listening. You know, what is it? She's like, what are you doing? I'm listening. And then he lets go and he says, you know what? This is the way things are. And, you know, it's terrible how all of these people died and all this stuff happened. But, you know, me fighting against it is not the right thing to do. It's time to let go, understand that this is a new thing. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a new thing. And, you know, it's time to grow up.
I can understand why that ending doesn't play well with a blockbuster, though. People want resolution. People want heroic deeds. And so I get that. It makes sense why they would change it. I think that that other ending, the real ending as we're referring to it, is a more poetic and beautiful ending. And also spurs a lot of discussion about things because you can then walk out of the theater or viewing the alternate ending on disc and say, well, do you agree with that? What is his responsibility at that point? What is his place in the world? What is anybody's place in a world that changed this way? And I think that it also is a better ending because you realize that it's not vestigial intelligence in the main antagonist zombie. It's an actual intelligence.
Yeah.
And so that colors the whole perception of the film that came before it, where you want to go back and watch and see the subtler cues about a real intelligence behind it, because it's very easy through the whole thing to say, well, this is just a higher animal. And you find out that, no, it's an actual sentient being that's trying to, you know, to resolve this, and you understand its desire to destroy Will Smith through the whole thing, because Will Smith is, to an extent, unintentionally antagonizing this thing because of who he has decided to do his experiments on. And so that makes even more sense. So, I mean, it's a shame they didn't go with that ending.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the whole flip in the book is that, you know, I am legend. Like, he is the legend. And the reason why he's the legend is because he's, you know, this unstoppable monster who kills all of those people, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I guess that kind of leads into the idea of adaptation. Now, I mean, Goldsman co-wrote this movie along with Mark Protosevich, who I think had been working on the script for years and years and years, like even back when Ridley Scott was planning on doing it with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I think at some point along the way, they took that screenplay and Goldsman, you know, rewrote it for Will Smith. And that
can I just say that an adaptation with Arnold Schwarzenegger in the lead would have been so gloriously awful that I would have probably liked it just for that. I mean, no disrespect to Mr. Schwarzenegger, who can buy and sell me thousands of times before breakfast, but seriously, I mean, that, you know, that it, that's almost like doubling down on the Dr. Freeze Olympic decathlete that they had in Batman and Robin. I mean, it literally is doubling down and being like, no, he's not just a scientist, he's the scientist. No, you're asking too big a leap here. Zombies I can accept. That I'm having trouble with.
I can see that. You know, at the same time, I'm like, well, if Ridley Scott thought it was a good idea, then, you know, I'm willing
Ridley
to...
Scott has had some bad ideas through time, Mike.
Sure.
I'm just going to throw that one out there. With it what you will.
That's true, too. You know, but I'd always give Ridley Scott the benefit of the doubt. You know, I would definitely want to see what that movie looked like for sure.
I think it would look a lot more like Omega Man.
I mean, that could
be even more than this one does.
And, you know, that's the other thing which is interesting. I mean, the credits in this movie are really interesting. It's like screenplay by, you know, Mark Protasevich and Akiva Goldsman, based on the screenplay by the Omega Man writers, based on the novel by Richard Matheson, which...
Yeah, it's a similar writing credit to Michael Mann's Last of the Mohicans, because that's technically based on the book and the previous screenplay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it really kind of, like, shows where the influences lie along the way. You know, it's not written by someone who necessarily grew up with the book. It's written by someone who grew up with the movie. And, you know, you just take it a step further back there to see where it came from. But yeah, you're right. Because of that, there's a lot of things which are in Omega Man, the movie, which are not in I Am Legend, the book. But even with that, I think it's definitely a truer adaptation to the book than Omega Man was.
You know, there's one question sitting in the back of my brain, and I'm sorry for like sort of like shifting over to the other side here, but one of the big arguments that I had with my friend Joey, who I mention every so often because I used to go to movies with him all the time, and Joey hated the decision to make the creatures CG in this. Mm-hmm. He desperately wished that they would have gone with just the actors and makeup as opposed to the CG zombies. He also didn't care for the Times Square effect in the beginning. Now, I look at something like the Times Square effect in the beginning, and it's imperfect, but at that time, it was such an amazing blending of everything. What did you think of the decision, though, to make the zombies CG?
I didn't have a problem with it. I mean, yeah, they definitely look kind of cartoony, but, you know, I can sort of forgive it. And I think it really sort of, like, speaks to the idea of adaptation, you know, like figuring this out for a different medium. They take it to an extreme here, because in the previous adaptations, it's like, okay, these things are vampires, you know, they're these weird creatures and everything. But, like, on the page, you can sort of get away with it, because if you're not specific about it, you can trick the audience in a sense by saying, like, you're seeing it through the perspective of the main character, right? So, like, he sees monsters. He is going to exaggerate, you know, what they look like in his mind, so that when he does come across people, he doesn't see them as monsters. And then we find out, like, oh, they are the monsters, you know, that, like, that kind of thing. And, like, that kind of, like, switch is something which is really hard to do on film when you're actually physically seeing these things, instead of, like, you know, just hearing someone's perception of them. But on film, it's like, okay, there are going to be things that make these things stand out, visual cues where you say, like, that is a monster, that is not. And they took that to an extreme here. And by taking it to an extreme, in the writing, you've got to alter how things play out in order to basically get that same point across, but in a different way, because visually, it's not going to work. So the fact that they did make them all CGI, I think, you know, you can talk about the quality of the effects, which, you know, is a little iffy, but I think the idea of pushing it to the max, pushing it to an extreme, is a really interesting choice, and it creates a lot of interesting problems creatively in terms of storytelling. And I think that the way that they handled it was really well, in a lot of ways, I think almost as effective or maybe more effective than what's in the book, but in a different way. And that, I mean, right there to me is one of the things which kind of like demonstrates how good this adaptation is. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah, no, I hear you.
I mean, what do you think about the CGI?
I tend not to care. In all seriousness, I tend not to care about stuff like that. It's the conceit doesn't bother me. I think that it put it in a position where it immediately got dated, as soon as the technology moved forward. That's for me, that's always going to be an issue with CG, is you have transcendent instances like Caesar in the Planet of the Apes movies, the current ones. But then you have, you know, stuff like this, which are steps on the way. But I've often been a defender of the steps on the way and said, you know, this is where it is here. And okay, when I watch the movie in 2017, I can say, oh, well, that's early aughts CG. That's not modern day CG. But that's okay, that's fine. There are plenty of movies where I can look at them and say, well, that effect looks pretty dated. You know, oh, that's a rear screen projection while they're driving. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I will say that, you know, and I don't know, I'm sure there's a lot of reasons for the turning points here or whatever, but this is like right around the time that Blu-ray transfers of movies became reference quality in a way that basically resulted in never having to upgrade, you know. And I know they're all, everyone's trying to get us to upgrade now with the 4K and the whatever, and, you know, high dynamic range for sure is worth it. But like, I was watching this Blu-ray of this 10-year-old movie, this 10-year-old transfer, and I'm like, wow, this image quality, you know, not in terms of the CGI or the effects or whatever, but just in terms of the pure image quality, is like reference level. It's fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's just a complete aside, but whatever, doesn't matter.
Well, one other question I have for you is, this is PG-13, obviously, to get butts in the seats for blockbuster season. I think they should have gone for broke and done an R-rated movie. I think they would have, had they been a little bit bolder, they would have had a film that would have been able to pull in money despite the R rating, as opposed to that being a stumbling block.
I mean, yeah, perhaps, and like, I could see maybe it being a better movie on some level if it were rated R, but at the same time, I mean, you know, this always goes back to something which, you know, I don't know, we always talk about, but it's like, if Aliens was rated PG-13, would it have been any worse of a movie? Would it not be a masterpiece anymore?
Like, to be honest with you, I look at a movie like Aliens and I think it's PG-13 compared to the way the standards have gone.
Right. And I mean, like, there's some movies where it's like, that needs to be rated R. Like, in order for that movie to be successful, it needs to be rated R. But this really doesn't feel like one of them. I mean, like, yeah, maybe you get a bit more gore and you could kind of push things a bit further. But would it result in a better movie? I kind of don't think so. It's not like I'd be opposed to it. It's not like I'd be like, oh, now I can't show it to my kids, you know, or whatever. But I mean, I guess I'm playing almost like devil's advocate here by saying, like, I don't think it matters. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, that's fair. I mean, I think that there are enough. I don't know. I mean, usually, I guess mentally, I'm still one of those that gets stuck in the idea of, oh, well, they could be more impactful with an R. They could, you know, remove some of the restrictions. But then I think about the way that the director handled some of the things, you know, like his dream sequence about what happened to his family and the scene with his dog. There are some directing choices where I think maybe if they felt, oh, well, we're going for an R, there might have been less palatable ways to deal with those scenes.
Yeah.
And instead, you know, I think that he probably found ways to be creative and therefore work within the limitation to make a, you know, I mean, those scenes, especially the scene with the dog, that's a rough one to get through, man. That is a really rough one. And I think that the performance from Will Smith in that scene in this movie as a whole is a real testament to why he is he's a really good actor. And I sincerely hope that he's able to start picking some projects that, you know, elevate his profile again.
Yeah. Someone at work just came in and asked me, he's like, what's your favorite Will Smith movie? What's his best performance? And I was like, Jersey Girl, which I do think is a pretty great performance where he plays himself. But then I was
of
like, no, no, no.
You chose Jersey Girl.
What?
Of course you chose Jersey Girl.
It's a great movie. You know, I don't care what anyone says. That movie holds up. And Will Smith's scene in that movie is awesome, where he's playing himself. it's a great little cameo. But no, but I mean, in reality, you know, after I said that, I'm like, no, it's I Am Legend. You know, he's really awesome in that movie. He's really awesome in this movie. And I mean, you know, that's one of the things that, that this movie does really well is sort of like, I mean, because it's really hard. It's like an entire movie with one guy, right, talking to himself. How do you do that? How do you make that interesting? And he totally pulls it off because he's so, you know, charismatic and everything. And I mean, he's fantastic in this. And also, I mean, we were talking about the direction, you know, Francis Lawrence, the guy who did the last three Hunger Games movies and some other stuff. A lot of music videos back in the day that are awesome. He's an amazing director, and this, I'm not going to say this is his best movie. I think maybe Catching Fire is his best movie, but this is certainly up there for sure.
Catching Fire, was that the second Hunger Games movie?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. There's Catching Fire, and then the last one is
Mockingjay.
Mockingjay.
Part one and part two.
Yeah,
I actually never saw them.
Have you seen any of them?
I saw the first two.
Okay.
But we all know how I feel about the type of ending that part two had.
Okay. See, yeah, I thought
that type, those tend to anger me.
I thought that was cool, but Mockingjay Part One, I'm like, oh man, this is amazing! Oh my god, this is the coolest thing ever! I can't wait for the finale. And then Mockingjay Part Two, I'm like, oh, so this is where we were going with this? Okay, you know, it's not bad, but
a lot of people felt that way about the book, The Mockingjay.
Yeah, which is why, like, after, like, you know, I kept on hearing, like, people are like, oh, the book, you know, and then I saw Part One, and I'm like, oh, those people are insane. You know, and then you get to the second half, and I'm like, I really do think, you know, and I think this most of the time, you know, I mean, obviously that's the thing to do is to take the last book in a trilogy or whatever and break it up into two movies for no real good reason other than to sell more tickets. And I just feel like as far as adaptation is concerned, as far as like structure of a trilogy is concerned, like, if you were to keep that as one movie, you know, slim it down to, you know, 2 hours instead of four, it would end up being a much better result. But I don't know.
There's only one time, in my opinion, that a book has been split into two films and it worked perfectly. And what? That is The Godfather and The Godfather Part Two.
And does that even really count? I don't know.
It does.
Does it?
It completely does, because it's the Michael stuff. Michael is the head of the family is what's not in the book. Mm-hmm. But the story of Vito Corleone's rise is in the book. And so they basically had a movie and a half, and then they just fleshed out the rest of it. And it's the only time I can think of where splitting it into two was the right decision.
If they were to do it today, they wouldn't even have the stuff with Michael in Part Two.
Probably not. Oh gosh. Well, no, I mean, if they were to do it today, they would go for broke, and they would have this what happened with Luca Brasi. There's a story from Luca Brasi's past that has never made it to any adaptation that is horrifying. Puzo went the extra mile in the book to really drive home exactly what a monster that guy was. And it was, I'm saying that today they would put it in there to make him more scary. And it's like, no, he's perfect the way he is on film. It's just, that's the right thing they did.
Yeah. Oh, well. So, and any final thoughts on Akiva Goldsman's work in I Am Legend?
Yeah, it holds up. I think if somebody hasn't seen it, it's well worth watching. I do. I think it's worth picking up. You're not going to walk away with the impression that it's an Oscar winner or anything like that. But Will Smith's performance and the majority, you know, up until the ending, I think the film really works.
You won't walk away with the impression that it's an Oscar winner or anything, and yet it's way, way better than the script that Goldsman won his Oscar for, in my opinion.
Irony works in very funny ways, Mike.
But I do think that it is a fantastic adaptation. You know, we talk about the adaptation of this book and all the movies on commentary Trek stars from a while back when we did our series on Richard Matheson. So head on over there and check that out. But I don't know. I mean, this movie really, really works for me, especially now with the alternate ending. I think that elevates it quite a bit. I mean, you talk about movies which, you know, sort of like jump in star ratings with one minor change or like an addition of some material and stuff like that. I mean, lots of times it doesn't make much of a difference at all, you know, whether it's the Star Wars movies or, you know, Kill Bill or, you know, Batman versus Superman or anything like that. But here, like, it is a substantial change, you know, it very much
for sure
alters your perception of everything that came before, and I think for the better. So definitely, if you track down this movie, get the alternate cut, not the theatrical cut. That's definitely the way to go. If you didn't particularly like the theatrical cut, check out the alternate cut. I mean, it's just the ending, which is different, really. But it's totally, totally worth it. And I don't know, I really do think that this movie is incredibly solid. So yeah. And cool. And an example of Goldsman at his best and Goldsman adapting other people's work to great effect. So yeah, check it out. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about I Am Legend today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
I think there's a better chance of what happens in the comics reflecting the television show as opposed to, like, the first TNG comic that had, like, the two bickering husband and wives that worked on the bridge, the Bickleys or whatever, and they ran around in capes for some reason. And it's just, like, they had these
that's
really...
That's canon
like,
in my head. Yeah, that's canon.
You're right.
To the journey!
And so I could see the Hirogen viewing themselves as very noble, very civilized. They don't let their prey suffer, but really they're doing these horrific things, just like we do here in the real world when we have to go fight wars.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they go home and they write an epic poem about it, and that makes it okay.
the Hirogen equivalent of Beowulf. Right?
Warp 5.
Gary Graham came over and said a couple of nice things, but the funny thing was he said, I've been on this show for 4 years. This is my first day on the bridge. You're over there firing the phasers? What is going on?
Standard orbit.
I was really hoping that Quinto would have a tie-in to, you know, when the Hobbit trilogy came out, you know, a few years ago. I was like, oh, they might tie into that, and Quinto can have a remix of the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins. They didn't quite go there, did they? So.
No, they did not. They did not. But, you know, there are certain things that you can, I guess, mirror or remake that is not something that should ever be remade.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts. And please leave us a star rating and a review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows, and most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways that you can contact us and let us know what you thought. You can find us on the Babel Conference, which is our listeners forum on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field and we'll come right up. If you want to contact the network on Twitter, you can find us at TrekFM or on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me as Kessel Junkie out there. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, which is on Podbean. You can find me over on the Nerd Party Network co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with a name familiar to Trek FM, Matthew Rushing. And you can also find me co-hosting Great Shot Kid with another name familiar to those of you who listen to Trek FM and this show, Mike Schindler.
Yeah, you can find me over there on the Nerd Party doing that, and you can also find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing a show called Commentary Track Stars, and you can find me on Trek FM right here doing a show called The Edge, which is all about Discovery, the new Star Trek television series, which you may have heard of.
Yes.
And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau. Thank you very much,
guys.
Thank
you. Thank you.
If you want to be like Jeff, Norm, and Chris, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. That's patreon.com/trekfm. Go over there to get all of the details, including perks like early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce and distribute these things, so we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the info at patreon.com/trekfm. Okay, well, that's it for Akiva Goldsman. We are, you know, approaching Discovery very, very fast. And, you know, there's that other Star Trek-like show, which is going to be debuting this month, next week, as a matter of fact. And that is The Orville, which is created by basically everyone who worked on Star Trek in the past.
And then Seth MacFarlane.
Who also worked on Star Trek in the past.
Oh my gosh, you're right. I always forget about that. You're right, he did.
Yeah.
He is a Star Trek creator.
Yes, he is, for sure.
Wow.
For sure. Yeah. So next week, we're going to take a look at the premiere.